House Labor will now come to order. It's 3:20 p.m. on April 13th. Glad it's not Friday. With us, we have Representative Tilton, Representative Hughes, Representative Keto, Representative Josephson, and Representative Culver. We do have a quorum to conduct business. We're going to have a full calendar today, and it's my intention that we may run up to 6 p.m. because we're getting short on time and long on bills. We're still getting a lot of Senate bills, but I think the first item we will have on the calendar is we have two of the boards and commissions nominees that we weren't able to address a couple days ago, and they've both are online. And then we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 bills to see how far we can get through. We've been joined by Representative Ledoux. Welcome, Representative Ledoux. I believe we'll take up the reviews of the qualifications of the two of the appointees. On Monday, we had three appointees that were lacking the application for the boards and commissions and were removed from the calendar. Two of them have resubmitted complete forms. And I would invite, I would entertain a motion to refer the appointees shown on the menu. That's jumping the gun, though, a bit, Conrad. Yeah. Yeah, I'll entertain a motion to refer the appointees shown on the memo to a joint session of the legislature for confirmation. Representative Hughes.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. I move to advance the confirmation of appointees referred to the House Labor and Commerce Committee for consideration and for the joint session of the House and Senate for consideration.
I'll object for purposes of discussion. Conrad?
Mr. Chairman, members have a, I'm sorry, for the record, Conrad Jackson, staff to Representative Olson before Debbie spanks me here. Members have a copy of a memo to the clerk listing the two appointees to the boards and commissions to which they have been appointed. Mr. Chairman, the members have had an opportunity to, or will have an opportunity to speak to the two appointees once we finish this, but at this time I'd like to just read onto the record the names of the appointees and the boards to which they've been appointed by Governor Walker. First, we have Brandon Emmett to the Marijuana Control Board and Joey Merrick II to the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation.
Mr. Emmett, are you with us? Could you read yourself on your, onto the record and then tell us why you would like to continue in this position?
Good afternoon, Chair Olson, esteemed members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. My name is Brandon Emmett. I was appointed by Governor Bill Walker to the State of Alaska Marijuana Control Board. I currently hold the industry slash public seat. I'm deeply concerned about Alaska and her issues. I think that the legalization of marijuana in Alaska is an important step forward in our state being honest with itself about demerit good use. Marijuana has been shown to be objectively safer than alcohol. I felt that it was my duty as someone who is not only a member of the cannabis community, but has had firsthand experience in dealing with the cannabis industry and those individuals who could potentially be affected by the cannabis industry to apply to this board. And I feel very fortunate that I've been able to represent the 56% of people who voted to enact ballot measure 2. I got my my start in the cannabis community at a very young age. I grew up around people who consumed cannabis responsibly, and I knew that it was objectively safer than alcohol. I had the opportunity to come on as a spokesperson for the campaign to regulate marijuana like alcohol, and we started, my colleagues and I started the Coalition for Responsible Cannabis Legislation. And throughout my college career and my time as a 911 paramedic, I saw that our marijuana laws did not, they didn't quite match with how cannabis was used by the people of Alaska, and I thought that it was very important that if a significant percentage of Alaskan adults can use cannabis responsibly, that it no longer be in the black market and be regulated, so we can actually track how it does affect our communities, and we can see tax revenue from the industry, and not have untracked revenues go into the black market. I bring a fact-based and public comment-driven approach to all of my positions that I've put forward on the MCB, and I look forward to being reconfirmed and continuing my work with the other members of the Marijuana Control Board. I think that we've have a pretty fantastic makeup on the board. We've got some pretty diverse views, but everyone on the board has been able to work professionally, and I think Alaska, being one of the first states, has the opportunity to do this right and to see marijuana legalization enacted in a way that is truly responsible, and that Alaska could sort of set the standard for the rest of the states as they move forward with their own marijuana legalization initiative. Thank you.
Anybody have a question? Representative Quito, followed by Representative Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Emmett, for putting your name forward and agreeing to serve on the board. One of the questions I have, I guess, thinking about the board makeup and having, I believe it's a public safety seat and a public health seat and a rural public seat. Your seat is one of the seats that is representing industry. And thinking about the board in terms of management or oversight like alcohol, the members of the board, of ABC board, that are performing in this licensure and business operation function are individuals that have experience in the business of running alcohol facilities, which is more like a business and less like knowing about alcohol, so they're not the chemists or the distillers or the brewers, although I think there might be a brewery seat on the ABC board. But my question for you really is, as a member of the board, I guess first your experience in being able to address issues specific to the different types of businesses and what they're going to experience in terms of ability to get licensure or ability to operate in various parts of the state, thinking in terms of maybe not the cultivation aspect but the testing and sale where we have transportation issues. I guess my question really is, how do you see, I'm looking at your resume, your experience being able to bring the industry knowledge of business aspects of the industry to the board. Can you fill me in a little bit, I guess?
Yeah, I can. So, through the chair. So I got my indoctrination in the marijuana industry in Oregon. And I actually, my first job was working on a medical marijuana farm. And so I off and on had been part of what their legal marijuana industry is, and had got to shadow individuals who were in cultivation, in the sale. They didn't have testing there at the time, but one thing that I've been really honest with people about is that acknowledging that there is a very healthy black market marijuana industry in Alaska, and that these individuals operate like normal businesses. Their business for the longest time had just so happened to be illegal. I've known people that have been in the marijuana industry my entire life, and so the transportation of marijuana, the retail sale, that sort of thing, although I've never actually participated in it myself, I've been around it, and it operates in much the same way that the alcohol industry does. People come to a place where they purchase it, They assess the product in almost the same way as alcohol. One issue that we are going to have, though, is with testing. That is something that is new to our state. And so I've looked very closely at Colorado and Washington and how they have implemented their testing. And then that's some discussions that we've had on the Marijuana Control Board is, okay, how do we get all of the marijuana tested? We have this issue, but you can't put it on an airplane. You can't put it on a boat. But per the initiative, all of the marijuana needs to be tested. So we're going to have to devise ways to either allow marijuana commerce to happen in a way that the transportation is legal, or we're going to have to find ways to get testing labs set up in all these communities that aren't on the road system. And I think it is going to be a challenge. Currently, we have 3 applicants, 4 labs that are on the road system. We have more lab applicants per capita than we have in you see in Colorado. We just have to determine what the size of those labs are, what the capacity is, and find a way to get the marijuana to these labs in a manner that it is legal. Because that is something that is truly new to the industry.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Emmett. And I guess I'm looking at the information you provided, and I didn't see any mention of the job or the activity in Oregon. So I guess I wasn't seeing any business and I guess I'm less concerned about the marijuana business aspect of your history and more about your knowledge of business operations, trying to facilitate the establishment and success of some of these businesses. I guess I'm just wanting to make sure that you understand something about the business aspect of the operation.
That's a very good question. I actually do have experience in upper-level management. On my resume there, I was the program manager of a helicopter-based search and rescue company. My nearest supervisor was the CEO of the company in Oregon, and I was responsible for not only the day-to-day operations, but also the handling of the office, making sure that the accounting department had all of the balance sheets completed. And so not only was I responsible for the running of a business, I was also responsible for the safety and well-being. The helicopter search and rescue industry is a high intensity, high risk sort of an industry. We have people jumping in and out of helicopters, and so my experience with that job, although not a marijuana job, I believe that it gave me the ability to see a business succeed, to be able to see everything that needs to be done from day to day and have it executed in a safe manner and be able to work under pressure at times. So my marijuana industry experience as far as a legal business goes is the COO of Cannabis Connoisseur, which is our new venture that is not licensed yet. So that will, that will be my actual first paying marijuana business, but I do have a significant background in upper-level management and know the needs of a business in order for it to succeed.
Thank you. A follow-up?
Certainly.
Thank you, Mr. Emmett. And I guess some of the other things that I have specific concerns about as this was moving through last year is just making sure that we're protecting public health and safety. And two of the things that I have a concern about, and I want to hear your perspective on how we can best address it. And the first one is advertising and making sure that we are protecting our children from easy access or predatory advertising of marijuana products. And then the second is, how do we as a state protect our roads and our businesses from individuals operating motor vehicles while impaired. And so if you can give me some thoughts on both of those questions, that would be helpful.
Thank you. Through the chair, the packaging and advertising of marijuana products is something that has been a big issue. Some of the other states struggled with this. We saw Colorado using some cartoonish advertisements to promote their product. I'm on the record on the Marijuana Control Board as not supporting any sort of packaging or advertisement that would appeal to children. I know that a regulated market protects our youth better than an unregulated market, but we don't want people who are under 21 consuming marijuana, you know, and so we don't want advertising that is appealing to children. We have regulations on the book right now that you cannot adulterate products. You know, you can't take an existing candy bar and add marijuana to it. We cannot, it's a loose definition, but you can't have products that appear like children's candy. Know, something that a child would associate with. And then the packaging for edibles has to be opaque. So if child resistant as well, it has to be at least 4 mil thickness and tough for, I believe, children under the age of 5 to stumble upon and open. And so I believe that through our restriction on advertising, and through our very robust system of packaging and prevention of adulterated products, that we are going to be able to reasonably assure that we will have the least amount of individuals under 21, one, being attracted to the product, and two, consuming it. And then on the issue of public safety, I actually, you know, have a background in public health, public safety. I was a 911 paramedic for 5 years before running the contract for air rescue systems, and I saw the damage that alcohol has done. You know, almost daily we see someone crash from being impaired. You know, I was only on one call in the entire 5 years that was marijuana related, and it was an individual having an anxiety attack, and the fears of stone drivers getting in their cars and killing people just hasn't really happened. It affects, you know, marijuana affects people differently. That said, we don't want to encourage people to drive stone just because it's legal. And then I do think that someone who's driving impaired, whether it's on alcohol or marijuana, should not be on the road system. And so there's currently in development now different series of tests to determine marijuana impairment. One is similar to a field sobriety test, and one of our my fellow board members, Mr. Millard, may have more information on that. But if someone is impaired on marijuana to the point where they cannot pass a field sobriety test, obviously they could be caught and should be on the road. But then there's on the analytical chemistry side, there's a test that's being developed that is a cheek swab test, and it can basically test to see if someone has just been smoking. The epithelial cells inside your cheek slough off at a pretty regular rate. And so this test, someone, you know, if they were assumed to be under the influence of marijuana, they could have a cheek swab done and then have an on-site test. Say, okay, this person has X number of milligrams of active THC in their bloodstream, and they appear impaired. This person shouldn't be on the road. So I would hope in these coming years that we can see a system of testing to determine if someone truly is impaired beyond the point that they can drive on marijuana be able to get these people off the roads.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Emmett. I guess I've had conversations with police in my communities, and one of the things that they indicated is that they do have to, in order to have individuals be able to determine whether or not somebody's impaired, have individuals that are called drug recognition experts, and they do have to go and get training. And we've got two here in Juneau for 30,000 people, and they said it's a quite an expensive process to get individuals trained, and then one of them has to be on call basically any time when there's a call. I understand that maybe we have not seen much of an issue with impaired operation of a vehicle or of heavy equipment, but we've also had marijuana illegal, and so I'm concerned that once we are fully legal and fully operational, we could end up with situations where we're going to see a lot more, and are we prepared to deal with it? And I'm not so sure we're there, but I think that's one of the things that the board can help with in maybe providing some direction on how businesses can engage with individuals that I think for alcohol monitoring, like alcohol, we have the TAMS cards for individuals that are serving that are supposed to recognize impairment and be able to address that. Do we need to do something similar for marijuana, and that's regulated within within the area that you're overseeing? So do you have any thoughts on that? And I think that's really my final question.
Through the chair, yes, that's a good question and a great point, and that's something that I've always championed. You know, before I was a regulator, I was an activist, and always thought that the best way to convince, you know, people of your position is to be proactive and to be positive and to recognize that people do have concerns. And I think that, you know, marijuana, it is a drug. It is, you know, objectively the safest drug that's bought in this country, but it still impairs people. And I think that in a regulated system, having rules in place where when someone does go into a venue where they can consume marijuana or they purchase marijuana, having the ability to have the education. So if someone is, you know, 21 and a new consumer and they're trying marijuana for the first time, that they can get that information that, yes, this will impair you. These are the effects. You know, this is how long you should wait before you can drive. This is, you know, how you can tell what the drug is doing to you and how you can be responsible in its use. And that's something you don't see in the black market. You know, people go and they buy a product and they're told it's good or it's not or whatever, and they make their own assessment. But I think through having a marijuana handler's card, where those individuals who will be selling marijuana have the ability to inform the customers, and then encouraging businesses to not only participate in this card program, but to be proactive themselves and to, you know, participate in information campaigns that tell people about the effects of marijuana, to tell them that they shouldn't be driving after they consumed, and give them resources to seek treatment if they feel that they've got an issue. I think that we'll have a more informed and ultimately safer population here in Alaska.
Any further questions? Then I guess it's up to me. Mr. Emmett, we had several of our peers ask us to ask a question, primarily because they're not on a committee vetting you, but do you have a business relationship with anybody else that's on the MCB?
I do not. So I have an Alaska Sea Corporation that has filed for a license. I am not business partners with anyone on the MCB. Some people have asked if Chair Schulte and I are business partners. We are not. Looking like we may actually be competitors. no one on the Marijuana Control Board is my business partner. I have no plans to go into business with anyone on the Marijuana Control Board in the immediate future.
Oh, great. Seeing no further questions, thanks a lot. Oh, Representative.
Thank you, Charles.
You sure? Thanks again.
All right. Have a nice day.
Do you have a question for Mr. Emmett? Yep. Thanks again. I think we got everybody. Next up will be Gasoline Development Board, Joy Merrick. Are you with us?
Yes, I'm with you, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, thanks again for joining with us today. Please state your name and affiliation and give us a indication on why you would like to continue on the board, why you'd like to be vetted and continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Labor and Commerce Committee. My name is Joey Merrick, and I am Alaska resident since 1984 is when I first moved to Alaska. And in 1989, I started working in the construction industry as an apprentice for the laborers, working on jobs, you know, up on the North Slope, a lot of pipeline work, and working, you know, also working other construction jobs on the pipeline, up and down the Taft line, and, you know, in refinery type of work, some power plant work, things like that. I've been working in the construction industry for over 25 years. I've worked in many capacities as far as that goes, from the person that was, you know, working from a general laborer, unloading the pipe to finishing up with the hydro test. And I've also worked as a manager, as a superintendent and a project manager. Let's see, I'm the president of the APJCC, which is the Alaska Petroleum Joint Craft Council. And I'm also the president of the District Council of Laborers. We represent about 5,500 Alaskans. I'm a trustee on the Laborers Training Trust, as well as the Pipeline Training Trust. Also a former board member of the Workforce Development Board there, the AWIP. My current job, I'm the business manager of the laborers, and I negotiate contracts, represent members. I deal with industry folks quite a bit, and I also negotiate with the AGC and, you know, and Alyeska Pipeline. You know, I think, you know, I certainly enjoy sitting on the board. I think we have a very good board that works well together, and a lot of people have, you know, bring different things to the table. I think what I bring to the table is, you know, I really, you know, I understand the how to put a deal together. You know, that's kind of what I mentioned before. You know, I know how to, you know, find that balance where, you know, I think I can look at it from both industry's point of view and Alaskan's point of view to make sure that we get a fair deal for everyone. I know this is a critical project. I have been honored to serve, and I hope to continue to be able to serve.
Anybody have any questions for Mr. Merrick? Representative Culver.
Thank you, Joey. Can you kind of explain to the committee how your hands-on experience as a project manager, superintendent on North Slope Pipeline projects, on the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, I think you've worked on for the contractor that has the maintenance contract, and then as well as your experience with logistics and operations of a marine terminal, you know, at Valdez, you worked there for a number of years in a supervisory capacity. How, what that brings to the table as far as practical knowledge to the ADGC board on pipeline logistics, construction, marine, transportation, those kinds of issues, how that plays out at the table there, and how that helps move the project along.
Well, through the chair, Representative Culver, I mean, I have worked in just about every stage of the project, so, you know, both on new pipeline up, you know, when we, you know, put in Alpine and did the boring, you know, the big bores to get the pipe under the Colville River, and you know, I worked on numerous projects on the slope, and then my work on the pipeline. Yeah, we've had tons of big projects. I think with our board, we've got a diverse bunch, and everybody has their own expertise. I think, you know, Chairman Cruz obviously has good construction background, and then certainly that's a big part of what I do as well. And, you know, the other part that I have is the workforce development piece. I think that's a real key to, you know, my ability to help on the AGDC board. You know, with the expertise that I have in working out in the field and doing the type of work that I did, when I first got on the board, they put me on the technical committee, so that's one of the committees that I serve on. I think where it's really going to come into play is even more so as we get closer to getting a project. I think, you know, that's where, you know, when you need 10,000 people to build this project, or however many we end up needing, I think that's where I'll really be helpful, and why, you know, I think it's so important that I remain on the board.
Oh, one last question. In all your years in Valdez, were you ever involved with the Port Authority, which started out in Valdez, or ended up in Valdez, I guess?
Mr. Chairman, no, I have not ever been involved with the Port Authority. I've always been, you know, our members are statewide, so we're, you know, we want to make sure we get the right pipeline wherever that may be, and the Port Authority is something I've never been involved with.
Any further questions?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Mr. Merrick, this is Andy Josephson. The Oil and Gas Competitiveness Review Board, I think, comes out of SB 21. Can you give us a little sense of how your service on that board may be of aid to AGDC?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, you know, I sat on that board for for a little while here, and I think once again, you know, when I was on that board, I think it's being able to look at things impartially was real important on that board. I think looking at things from both sides is one of my strong points. We didn't have, I was on the board early, so there wasn't a lot, before I got off the board that we got into a lot of the technical details, so I didn't spend a lot of time on that board, Representative.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Keto.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Merrick, thank you for putting your name forward. Appreciate your comments. One of the questions I have, just in general for you, I think thinking about your experience and your knowledge of the construction industry in Alaska, can you provide just a brief statement about what perspective that you bring to the board that may be unique?
Representative Keto, through the chair, what's unique is basically my knowledge of both how to interact with industry, how to do the work. Like I said, I've actually literally unloaded the pipe, put the skids down, to unload it. I've been on the tie-in crew, the fire line, I've been on every stage, insulating the pipe, tie-ins, like I said, hydro testing. So, I kind of know the whole sequence of how a pipeline is built, and been very involved with that. And then that tied into my workforce development. I think it's just really, it's not 100% unique, because I know that the Commissioner of Labor certainly has a lot of experience in workforce development. But, being a trustee on the Pipeline Training Trust, that's what we do, is we're teaching folks, and I think that's really key. So I guess really my workforce development experience, along with my working as a laborer on the job, as a foreman on the job, as a superintendent, and as a manager, I've really kind of been on it at every level. So I think that's that's the uniqueness that I bring to the board.
Thank you.
Well, thanks again for joining us today. And that includes the two that we have. We have one left, hopefully tomorrow. And with that, what are the wishes of the committee? Or is that me? I'll lift my objection to moving these names forward, and by signing the lesson, no way commit you to a vote on the floor. Just signing to get their names out of committee. And I'd entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I moved earlier. I can move it again if you'd like me to.
It might take three times, I think, okay. The way things are going today.
I move to advance the confirmation of appointees referred to the House Labor and Commerce Committee for consideration to the joint session of the House and Senate for consideration. And I'd remind members that your signature on the committee's report in no way reflects your vote during the joint floor session.
Seeing no opposition, paperwork is going around the room, and we'll take a brief at ease. We're back on the record. Next item on the calendar today is Senate Bill 157. To present the bill, we have Forrest Wolf, staff to Senator McGuire, who could not be here. Please state your name and affiliation and walk us through it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon and thank you. My name is Forrest Wolf, and I'm staff to Senator McGuire. Senate Bill 157 is a very simple, narrow housekeeping measure that seeks to clarify some rather vague language in Alaska statutes. Quite simply, it does two things. One, it creates a definition of amusement-style devices to include arcade-style games of skill, such as skee-ball, pinball machines, claw machines, etc., while specifically excluding from this definition games of chance, such as slot machines and video poker. And the second thing that it does is it adds that winning tickets or tokens or credit from these types of amusement devices and games, which can be redeemed for toys or other novelty items, does not constitute gambling under Alaska law. The goal of this bill is to ensure that businesses that feature these types of amusing devices and games have sure-footed legal ground to operate in Alaska. For example, one of the more well-known of these types of businesses, Dave & Buster's, has plans to open a location at the Diamond Center Mall in Anchorage. Dave & Buster's will spend an estimated $10 million to build this facility, and once operational, it will employ approximately 160 workers. Moreover, this addition is the keystone to a larger expansion project for the mall that is anticipated to employ upwards of 200 construction workers and another $13 million in spending. In these times of economic uncertainty and strain, this is an effective way to add well-paying jobs to Alaska's economy. Once again, it needs to be made absolutely clear that this bill does not in any way legalize traditional gambling. Online, I have Lee Baxter from Holland & Knights, and then Dave & Buster's General Counsel and Senior Vice President Jay Tobin, both to answer questions. Thank you again for hearing Senate Bill 157 today. We ask that you support this effort to clarify Alaska's laws so that these family-friendly businesses see Alaska as a viable environment in which to operate and therefore benefit Alaska's economy and people.
Wade, have you walked through the sectional, but it looks like we only have two. And all the fiscal notes are zeros?
That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
One of them appears to be done by my daughter, Valerie Rose. Just coincidental.
Okay.
She does not work for the Department of Law.
Okay.
But with that, we think we'll go to public testimony. Jay Tobin, are you with us?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, as was just indicated, I'm available as a representative of the company simply to respond to questions. Really do not have any formal testimony to bring forth today.
Oh, perfect. But could you state your affiliation so we can read you onto the record?
Yes, sir. My name is Jay Tobin. I'm the Senior Vice President and General Counsel of Dave & Buster's.
Anybody have any questions? Representative Kito.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Wolf. So can you describe, you say it's kind of a technical fix or a housekeeping measure. Is there something, is it just not addressed in statute, or is it something that, I guess if you could help me understand what this does that current statute is not
right,
able to
right.
do?
So through the chair, Representative Kito, the way it was explained to me is that it's rather vague, and it's not necessarily currently illegal to have these types of establishments. It's just that, for example, Chuck E. Cheese has been operational for over 30 years. I remember going there when I was a kid. But they're a franchisee operation, so therefore you pay, you say, I want to open a Chuck E. Cheese. You pay for the rights to use their trademark stuff and their their equipment and everything like that, but you have to take on the onus and the risk of building the facility. So if the state later comes in and says, hey, look, this is illegal, you know, you're the one that has the big loss. The company doesn't really do anything. Now, Dave & Buster's, and maybe perhaps Mr. Tobin can answer this a little more clearly, Dave & Buster's is not a franchisee operation. They're still all essentially owned by one company. So it's they have to look and be 100% certain that an area they're looking to go into, a market they're looking to go into, to open a facility and spend, you know, a sizable portion of money is going to be, like I said, 100% certain it's viable.
Thank you.
That makes sense, yeah.
Simply to add on to that, I think that, as was indicated previously, we are looking to invest $10 million in construction of a new store, and the existing law, as well as an attorney general opinion, leaves us in a gray area as to games that we have that might confer the right not simply to replay the game, but upon successful performance or successful outcome of the game, the skill would allow the game player to win tickets, which could then be redeemed for toys, candy, electronic devices that are offered at the same facility where the games are skill located. Not clear in our minds, nor in the minds of our local council, as to whether or not this type of operation would be permissible under existing law, although it appears that there are a number of establishments operating within the state of Alaska at this time that are very, very comparable to what it is that we do. So we simply wanted to have some clarity before making this sizable investment that our operations would be in full conformance with the laws of the state of Alaska.
Hello? Bert's saying we'll do. Any further questions for the sponsor or?
Yes, just one.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Relative to Section 3, the new paragraph on amusement device through the chair. So philosophically, I'm generally opposed to gambling, and this isn't gambling. But what assurance can you afford me that the first clause wouldn't bleed into something that's akin to gambling? So I'm looking at page 2, line 23, amusement device. Okay.
Right. So I think through the chair, Representative Jefferson. So there we're specifically stating that these types of amusement devices are excluded from gambling, from the definition of gambling. And then we also, at the end of that paragraph, obviously there it says that this definition, we're establishing a new definition of an amusement device, and that definition does not include your casino-style games and games of chance, you know, your draw games, slot machines, roulette wheels, and all that stuff.
So. Right. May I follow up?
Certainly.
Through the chair, I hear what you say on that, but I have no idea what a claw machine is or similar machine. I don't know what that means. So I just want some confidence that this isn't, even if you've said it's not gambling, that it's not actually gambling.
through the chair, Representative Josephson. So a claw machine is the machine that you put your quarter in and has a crane that comes down and it picks up a toy of some sort.
Okay.
And the argument that we're making is that those are more games of skill to where you can get good at things like that, and whereas it's versus like a game of chance where it's just kind of all, you know, up to chance. So.
Okay.
And typically the grand prize is a teddy bear, which.
Mr. Chen, that's correct.
Any further questions? With that, public testimony is open. Is there anybody else in the room that would care to testify? Seeing none, we also online have Lee Baxter. Are you with us? Are you here for questions?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm also here to primarily answer any questions that you have about the technical legal aspects of SB 157. I don't have any prepared testimony per se, but I can answer any questions you have about the drafting of the bill and how it operates.
We have two attorneys on council that are just clawing to ask you questions. Representative Josephson, none?
No.
Representative Ledoux? Representative Hughes? Not an attorney.
No, this isn't. This is just a comment.
I was just thinking passage of this might, we might have a few more of these devices around, and I think it's going to make my life as a grandparent a little more expensive. Thank you.
Yeah, I'll second that. Any further questions for the sponsor or the two people from Dave and Buster's? Anybody online? Anybody signed up that we missed? With that, we'll close up public testimony and bring it back to the committee for questions. Anybody have any thoughts? Anybody have any motions?
I do have a motion, Mr. Chair. I move SB 157 version 29-LS1264-W from committee with individual recommendations and three attached zero fiscal notes.
Seeing or hearing no opposition, the bill will move out of committee. At ease. Next item on the calendar today is Senate Bill 158. Short title is not an act related to real estate. Not doing the real estate license here. We're doing Costello. Okay, got it. We have too many real estate bills. Next item is Senate Bill 158, a real estate bill. You want to read yourself on the record and tell us all about it?
Certainly. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members, or excuse me, Mr. Chairman. I'm so sorry. Just step back from that right there. So, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Weston Eiler, staff to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. The chair of the committee gives her apologies. She is tied up in another committee this afternoon and asked me to present in her stead. Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 158 is a companion bill to a bill that the committee has heard within the last 3 weeks. With your permission, I'll present the bill, and I'm happy to take any questions, and we'll leave it up to you if you'd like me to walk through a section or flush out the issue more thoroughly. Senate Bill 158 raises requirements to become a licensed real estate broker in the state of Alaska. There are several tiers of professional licensee within the Alaska real estate industry that I can talk about, but this bill was brought forward to raise the standards for becoming a broker, the highest level of real estate licensee in Alaska. It was brought forward by the industry to improve professional standards and protect consumers. Real estate brokers handle a variety of complex business transactions that affect the public. Brokerage trusts, deposits, rental money, and those tasks over the last 10 to 15 years have become increasingly complex. Brokers have final signing authority on real estate deals handled by their firms. They supervise associate brokers and licensees that are just beginning in the real estate industry. And by state law, there is only allowed to be one broker per real estate firm. So the special role that brokers have in the real estate industry by only having one per firm is recognized in state law. During the past two decades, as I mentioned, Mr. Chairman, the industry has seen real estate deals become increasingly complex. You're seeing configurations of real estate transactions such as deeds in lieu of trust, short sales, and there's kind of an increasing complexity to the way that the industry is moving forward. What this bill does is increases the current standards for becoming a broker, which again is the terminal and highest level of real estate professional. Specifically, the bill would increase the length of time applicants must have held a real estate license from 24 to 48 months. It increases the continuing education requirements from 15 to 30 hours and adds additional training and experience to help basically brokers perform their duties better. This again was brought forward by request of the industry and the Alaska Real Estate Commission. That concludes my comments, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to answer any questions or also walk through a sectional analysis of the bill.
How about the sectional? And we'll get the questions after that.
Of course, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, this is an act relating to real estate broker licensure relating to the Alaska Real Estate Commission and providing for an effective date. Section 1 amends statute to require individuals complete 30 hours of continuing education prior to being a licensed real estate broker or associate real estate broker rather than 15 hours. Section 2 requires applicants for real estate broker license have at least 48 months of active continuous experience as a real estate licensee within the past 60 months rather than 24 months of active continuous experience within the last 36 months. Section 3 amends AS 0888171 to require applicants for an associate real estate broker license to have at least 48 months of active continuous experience as a real estate licensee within the past 60 months rather than the past 24 months of active continuous experience. Section 4 addresses applicability for the effective date, and Section 5 is transition language that allows for compliance with the Administrative Procedures Act. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I might add, we have a CS that we're going to be adopting briefly, but any questions for Weston?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair for Weston, your last name is?
Oh, Eilerman.
Eilerman. Okay.
No, excuse me. Through the chair, Representative Josephs, and my last name is Eiler.
Eiler. Mr. Eiler, a couple questions. There's a lot of pressure for all of us now because of the volume of things we're being asked to read in the closing days. There's been some pushback on this issue, and I would like you to, I've never really asked anyone to do this, but could you state the case of those who oppose this bill? Can you give me the criticisms of your bill? I know they concern a belief that it's anti-competitive. That's one complaint, but can you just sort of state their case for me?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, our office hasn't actually received any formal criticism outside of one potential broker applicant,
okay,
who had questions regarding the timeline.
Okay.
So I'm not sure I can answer that question.
All right.
If you have particular questions, I could speak to them. But
no, that's okay. I'm going to move on, Mr. Chairman. Can you, at page 2, lines 27 and 28, the furnishing satisfactory proof of errors and omissions insurance, we just dealt with this in an audit, and I'm curious about whether or not that is a reasonable request in the bill.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, if I'm hearing your question correctly, page 2, lines 27 through 28,
mm-hmm.
Under the bill, that is actually existing language that is not amended by the bill.
Okay.
That section 3, the amendments are for the length of time that provides for active and continuous experience.
Okay.
So that's existing language in statute that's not covered by the bill.
Right.
I know that we have members of the industry and the Real Estate Commission available for to testify and talk about some of the broader issues that I know the committee has been involved with regards to the commission.
All right. And just a comment about that, those lines. While I see that it's not being amended, it's, I don't know if we call it hollow language, and I'd have to look at Title VIII and see if that's what's been problematic in terms of finding, you know, insurance.
You might want to hold that question for the CS.
Yeah.
It might become apparent at the, that time. Representative Hughes? Representative Ledoux.
Yeah, I guess I want to comment that I'm somewhat surprised that your office has not received any letter criticizing this bill, because my office has actually received quite a few letters criticizing this bill. So it just sort of surprises me.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I've spoken personally with a gentleman who is a real estate licensee, but outside of that, the correspondence that we've received from our office regarding this bill are letters of support from the Alaska Real Estate Association, the Real Estate Commission.
Thank you.
Again, we do have 11 people signed up to testify, so we've got a feeling we'll have a pretty good cross-section. Recognize a few of the names. Any further questions? And with that, I'd entertain a motion to adopt the CS.
Mr. Chair, I move CSSB 158, version 29-L, S1303/H as the working document.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion. Conrad Jackson from my staff will walk us through the CS and what it does.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Conrad Jackson, staff to Representative Olson. The CS you have before you, version H, makes two changes. First is on page 3, line 16. It inserts new section 4, which repeals 0888172E. This section was referred to, as Representative Josephson mentioned, in the hearings of a couple of other bills. And this section deals with this, all of 172, deals with the requirement that a real estate broker, associate real estate broker, or real estate salesperson shall carry and maintain errors and omissions insurance. These E&O policies must either be part of the master policy or an equivalent policy. 172E specifically speaks to that if the master policy is not in effect, this requirement to have E&O insurance is void. Since the Commission has had difficulty in obtaining a master E&O policy, it was felt that by repealing this prohibition, it's like a positive negative. By repealing this section, it would require all of those real estate professionals to carry a master or an E&O policy. The second change is an effective date inserted in a new section 9. This would make section 2 and section 4 effective on January 1, 2018. That is, the effective date of the repealer would be January 2018. It also pushes out the requirement for this continuing education and expanded education requirements so that anyone that is in the process of becoming or being licensed as a broker has the opportunity to complete that and is not cut off in midstream. And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, of course, that would require a small title change to the bill, but that's the extent of the changes in the CS.
Representative Culver.
Okay, through the chair, Mr. To Conrad, so Section 4 repealed the pool language requiring E&O and how that was working, correct?
Representative Culver, through the chair, that repeals, let me just read the exact language here. Currently, 172E reads, if the Commission is unable to obtain a master error and omission insurance policy to insure licensees that meets the term and conditions established under B of this section, the requirement that a real estate licensee carry and maintain errors and omissions insurance under 0888172 is void. So by removing that section, it's no longer void. They will be required to have E&O insurance.
Mr. Chair, I guess this is for you. I think I sent your staff and you an email yesterday. It was my intent to strip out, and that was the amendment I asked for in this, the requirement for E&O as a requirement as being a broker, and it was related to this snafu over this pool, and I'm not sure that you know, that's quite customary practice to get a license that we require E&O insurance. And I would, my preference, and if it has to be conceptual, is not to require E&O insurance. It's not necessarily easy to get. And that was the intent of my request in to your office, and the 24-hour deadline was, as you're working on that CS, not just, because now we are requiring it, we've taken out that pool that helped these new brokers or less financially secure folks to get it through a pool that didn't work out. I feel it's more in the public interest to not require it of everybody, and so that's what how I would like to handle it. So
I believe they've had 7 years to find it, and it was at their request originally that that legislation be placed originally, and then there virtually was, depending on who you talk to, either minimal or no follow-up. But we do have people that will be addressing that. We've got a number of people in the room, but
I could address one of those comments. So I do have a constituent, Tracy Berrickman, that is a member of the Real Estate Commission.
I believe she's calling in.
Yeah, and she could put it on the record, but my understanding from her,
why don't we let her put herself on the record instead of you telling us what you think she's going to say?
Okay.
Because maybe it's different. Representative Ledoux.
I guess I'd like to know what professions will require E&O insurance for their licenses and what professions we don't require it. Because, for example, I'm a member of the Bar Association, and I don't think E&O insurance was ever required of lawyers. I don't think it's required of doctors. I mean, so I'm trying to get a feel for why which occupations we've determined that it's in the public interest to have E&O insurance, and why.
Do we have Lori Wang Heyer in the room still?
Mr. Chairman, she was called away to another committee hearing.
Any further questions? At this point in time, what we'll do is we'll hold the bill over till tomorrow until we can get somebody to answer that question.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess I could draft an amendment, try to have it ready, but that would be my intent. I'd like to see this taken out. I don't think it's, as the previous representative has spoken, I don't think it's common practice for occupations to
again, Mr. Culver, okay. Why don't we let Lori Wang Heyer tell us who other what other organizations may be required? Again, and they came to us looking for this originally, marching lockstep. There was no opposition that I can recall that didn't want it, or we wouldn't have done it. It was at their request. And with that, we'll hold the bill over until tomorrow. Calendar just got shorter. And it might have. We're back on the record. Next item today is Senate Bill 165, Alcohol Board, Minors, Marijuana Checks. Presenting the bill is Senator Peter Michicki, and Chuck Kopp is Chief of Staff. Thank you for joining us today.
Please have a...
Do we have a equipment malfunction?
You're allowed to sit down here.
Oh. Brief at ease. Thank you. Back on the record. Welcome back, Senator Michicki, and please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
How about it?
Senator Peter Michicki, District O. I want to thank you and committee members for hearing this bill today. It's a privilege to move forward with a measure that we believe brings a healthy and reasonable balance of representation to our Alcohol Beverage Control Board, decriminalizes youth alcohol possession and consumption offenses, and opens up a new horizon of opportunity for youth under 21 years of age who make a mistake consuming or possessing alcohol. Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 165 is the product of an ongoing comprehensive multi-year modernization process of Title IV of Alaska statutes, which is being carried out by a large and diverse stakeholder group who since 2012 have put over 8,000 hours of work into this ongoing reform. The work is continuing even now to review our alcohol laws pertaining to licenses, the role of the board, local option, underage drinking, and internet sales, and you'll likely see a secondary Title IV bill next year dealing with these other issues. Senate Bill 165 retains the current five-member ABC board structure and simply changes one of the board seats to one represented by public safety. I'm pleased to say the proposed balance and composition of the ABC board has the support of the stakeholder group, which includes the industry group, CHAR, Public Health, and Public Safety. Probably the most significant reason I agreed to partner with the stakeholder group in this reform effort was the opportunity to address the fact that we were placing damaging obstacles into the lives of young people under current minor consuming laws. Today, a police officer can be called to a house party attended by minors, and after finding alcohol at the party, cite offenses for everyone present, whether or not the majority of the young people have actually been consuming alcohol. And the effects can and have been devastating. Being on court view and losing a driver's license can have a long-lasting negative effect and can just be the result of being at the wrong place at the wrong time, and I know none of us here were ever in that situation as a young person.
But many of our top students with a life of promise have been caught in this situation. Remember, this is an offense that's only illegal because of their age. Illegal at 20, legal at 21. The present practice of revoking the privilege to drive and cancellation of motor vehicle insurance for non-driving motor minor consuming offenses severs ties to social institutions they need to succeed, like jobs, education, and family. A new approach like Senate Bill 165 is needed. Swift and certain violation, which is a $500 fine, versus slow and uncertain. Misdemeanor offenses entailing jury trials, prosecution, public defenders, and court time, extensive justice system costs. It goes on from there, Mr. Chairman. MCA offenses should not trigger a loss of driving privilege, as they are not driving-related. Remember, if they are caught with a DUI or something, that's a whole different crime. It's not minor-consuming. The data demonstrates that what we are doing contributes to the minor having a far more negative outcome in their lives and has not led to positive behavioral correction. Mr. Chairman, our stakeholders identified the value of rehabilitation over punishment for young people who are still forming values and behavioral patterns and the need to support success rather than contribute to barriers that promote failure. The bill restores under 21 alcohol status offenses to true violations, removes criminal penalties, and establishes a fine of $500, which may be reduced by the court to $50 if the individual completes an alcohol safety action program or takes advantage of a community diversion panel, which can include proven alternatives of youth courts and tribal circles. It also provides that simple violations of minor consuming and minor in possession laws would not appear on court view, which has caused many of our top performing Alaska youth to be denied employment and scholarship opportunities. It also clarifies that minors are allowed to play and work on golf courses, which also serve alcohol, as long as certain criteria are met. Finally, Senate Bill 165 requires background checks on marijuana establishment licenses, the same that is now required of alcohol licenses. Remember, the initiative asked that marijuana be regulated like alcohol. So finally, Mr. Chairman, I want to particularly thank the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, Alaska Children's Trust, Alaska Wellness Coalition, CHAR, the Matsu Health Foundation, Providence Hospital, Seward Prevention Coalition, Recover Alaska, and the Rasmussen Foundation, who have supported this ongoing effort for over 3 years. I'm grateful for the many letters of support submitted to the body, and I'd also like to note that the minor consuming law revisions have the support of the Alaska Peace Officers Association. Mr. Chairman, if I can now, I'd like to turn it over to my Chief of Staff, Mr. Chuck Kopp, and Cindy Franklin, the ABC Board Executive Director.
Well, what I'd like to do is have Chuck walk us through the sectional, and then at that point in time we'll adopt the CS. Have Conrad walk us through that, and then we'll open it up to committee testimony and then open it up to everybody in the room.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Chuck Kopp, staff to Senator Michiki. Section 1 of the bill repeals and reenacts Alaska Statute 406020, which relates to the appointment, the reappointment, and qualifications of members of the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board, and establishes definitions. Specifically, Mr. Chairman, what this does is it adjusts the makeup of the board from the current makeup, which is three public members, one representing rural Alaska, and two industry members representing their alcohol licensees, to a board which is still five members and still two industry members. But it designates one of the public member seats as a public safety seat, one still representing rural Alaska, and one just being a general public member that is unaffiliated with public safety or public health. This was an amendment made in the other body, which was supported unanimously by our steering committee and by the Alaska Cabaret Hotel and Retailers Association, Alaska CHAR. And we feel it provides a very good balance to the board. Mr. Chairman, in Section 2 of the bill.
I'm just curious about one thing in Section 1C. What's the rationale for a wholesale alcoholic beverage licensee or officer not to be allowed to serve on the board? I assume that a retail licensee could be on the board, and I'm just sort of curious about that.
Mr. Chairman, as we said earlier, we do have Cindy Franklin, Executive Director of the ABC Board, online, and if we want to take that question now, I would defer to her expertise.
I think we'll wait until after we get the CS adopted and do it all at once. And I might add for the committee that we also have Jeff Jesse in the room for questions, Nancy Mead, court system questions, Matt Davidson, Department of Health and Social Services questions, and we do have Dale Fox, the head of CHAR, online as well. So I think we've got about everybody covered.
Right.
Do you want me to hold my question on that section?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll continue. Section 2 and Section 3, Mr. Chairman, are conforming changes to current drafting style, changing the terms from chairman to chair in both those sections. Section 4, Mr. Chairman, actually Sections 4 through 8 all have to do with access of persons under 21 to licensed premises. In Section 4 specifically, it adds a reference to 411110, permitting access to club premises by a person under 21 years of age. These are patriotic clubs, Mr. Chairman, if no alcoholic beverages are present or if the person has an active duty military card. It also changes age of 21 years, that terminology, to current drafting style, 21 years of age. And it identifies circumstances under which minors may be employed on licensed premises. Section 5, Mr. Chairman, amends 416.049C, allowing juveniles 16 and 17 years of age. Again, this is under the under 21 access to licensed premises. So it allows juveniles 16 and 17 to be employed on golf course licensed premises as long as they are not serving alcohol, have written consent of a guardian or parent, and an exemption granted by the Department of Labor. This is a technical fix in the law, Mr. Chairman. This has been actually a practice of young people working on golf courses, but because many golf courses do have a section where they serve alcohol, we needed to make sure the law covered that, so that would be a lawful activity. Section 7 also has to do with golf courses, Mr. Chairman. That also amends 416.049D to allow minors who are 18 to 20 years of age to be employed within the licensed premises of a golf course as long as they do not sell, serve, deliver, or dispense alcoholic beverages. Section 8, Mr. Chairman, adds a new subsection G to this same under 21 on licensed premises portion of the law, which permits access by minors to golf courses for the purpose of playing golf. And it adds new subsections making unauthorized presence by a minor on licensed premises a violation, punishable by a fine of $500, which must be charged and filed with the court as a separate case. The fine may be reduced by a court to $50 if the minor supplies a proof of completion of an alcohol safety action program or a community diversion panel. And, Mr. Chairman, community diversion panels are what we commonly know as youth courts or tribal youth circles.
Probably just like one down the hall from both of our offices?
Yes.
That and one. And Jenny's online, too. She just came online, so she'll be available.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Section 9 repeals and reenacts AS 416.050 to make minor consuming a violation, punishable by a fine of $500, which must be charged and filed with the court as a separate case. This particular terminology, Mr. Chairman, is so the case doesn't go up on court view. If it's charged as the violation it is, it will not appear on court view. But if it's combined with another criminal offense, it goes up on court view. It's interesting that if you're a young person, you can assault, maybe even kill someone. But when you're 18, that goes off your record. But yet we have these minor consuming offenses stay with kids the rest of their life. So that's one thing we are trying to address with the bill, is to make sure they do not follow them the rest of their life on court view. And we worked with the court system on this. And again, Mr. Chairman, the fine may be reduced by a court to $50 if the minor supplies proof of completion of an alcohol safety action program or a community diversion panel. Section 10, Mr. Chairman, simply removes ambiguity in the signage law with more specific and accurate language. And as we saw on page 3, section 4 of the bill, there are a few exceptions to the general rule that prohibits minors on licensed premises. Section 11, Mr. Chairman, deals with court records of persons under 21 years of age, and this adds a new provision which prevents the court system from publishing on a publicly available website, otherwise known as CourtView, the record of a violation of under 21 on licensed premises or minor consuming or a similar municipal ordinance if the violation was charged separately and not joined with another minor offense or criminal charge. Section 12, Mr. Chairman, adds the definition of community diversion panel. Section 13, Mr. Chairman, was an amendment that came in judiciary on the other body, which simply authorizes the Department of Public Safety to obtain a criminal history record check of a person applying for a license to operate a marijuana establishment, as is currently required for alcohol beverage licensees. This is the same board, Mr. Chairman, the Alcohol, Marijuana, and Control Board. So this would make it so that the regulation, just like alcohol, happens for both sets of licensees. And that has, this clarifies that and makes it, and again, Ms. Franklin, the board, can speak further to that. Section 14, Mr. Chair, requires applicants for registration to operate marijuana establishments to submit to this criminal history record check, which DPS is authorized to do in the previous section. Section 15, Mr. Chair, simply removes the minor consuming alcohol nexus to motor vehicle insurance cancellation. We're no longer canceling insurance due to those violations with this bill. Section 16, Mr. Chair, again removes the nexus to driver's license penalties for a minor consuming violation. And the Senator Michiki stated this earlier, but if it is a driving offense, it is cited for minor driving after consuming or DUI or other offenses, but a simple minor consuming offense is never a driving offense. It's possession or consuming, but not related to a vehicle. Section 17, Mr. Chair, amends AS 2815-191, which makes it so that the court no longer has to report these records to DMV of a minor consuming violation within 5 days, because we have removed the nexus to the driver's license. In Section 18, Mr. Chairman, this removes the reference to DMV not issuing a driver's license to a person whose license was revoked for minor consuming alcohol. Section 19 amends the uncodified law of the state of Alaska, and it adds a new section describing a direct court rule amendment to Rule 17A, Alaska Rules of Minor Offense Procedure, providing an exception to when a prosecutor may join a minor offense with a related criminal offense. Section 20, Mr. Chairman, spells out the exception, and it amends the uncodified law, which says that it provides that a prosecutor may not join a minor offense for a violation of under 21 on licensed premises or minor consuming or minor possession of alcohol with a related criminal offense. Section 21, Mr. Chairman, repeals the various sections that have to do with denial, cancellation, or non-renewal of insurance for minor consuming violations, court revocation of a driver's license for minor consuming alcohol, and health and social services agreements under delinquent minor rules to revoke a driver's license for minor consuming alcohol offenses. Section 22 is the applicability provisions, and Section 23 is the transition provisions relating to membership on the ABC board. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are there any urgent questions, or do you want to hear the CS first, or go ahead?
I thought we heard the CS, but just a quick, if I may.
No worries. CS is coming up next.
All right.
A couple minor changes.
Okay. Yes, through the chair, I'm curious about the one of the last items you mentioned on page 9, subsection G. So is the idea here that the prosecutor, I think customarily a prosecutor would never see this thing to begin with, but an actual prosecutor. But a prosecutor, if he or she wants to cite a minor for a violation, can do so, or the system, quote unquote, can do so, but it's not going to be in the same case file as some other random criminal offense. Is that all that's going on there?
Through the chair, it's very close, Representative Josephson. Thank you for that question. So on the charging document, it's often referred to as the criminal intake disposition. Mm-hmm. A prosecutor can have all offenses committed, so if you can have a minor consuming alcohol, maybe there was criminal mischief, maybe there were several things. Mm-hmm. What this is just saying is that those criminal offenses are on a separate charging document and the minor consuming alcohol is on a separate document. The idea being that the other criminal offenses should be up on court view if there's other criminal behavior.
Okay.
And it also addresses the situation that 70-some percent of minors never reoffend on this offense, which is why we're trying to keep the minor consuming offenses separately as violations and off-court view.
Can I ask one more question?
Certainly.
Just as a primer for me or some background, somehow unbeknownst to me, if an 18, I want to be specific about this, if an 18, 19, or 20-year-old, just those 3 years, consumes alcohol and is caught doing that, is that a criminal offense under current law? Can they go to jail for that under current law? Yeah.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, no, that is a violation under current law.
Okay. So I was misinformed. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Ledoux, followed by Representative Hughes.
So under current law, in order to be charged with minor in possession, you don't have to be, all you have to do is be at some place. They don't have to prove that you were actually in possession of something.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, certainly you still have to do your police work. But I think what the bill sponsor was referring to is the average scenario where you walk into a room, there's alcohol everywhere and minors in there and no one knows who brought it or how it got there, but not necessarily everyone was consuming. And so there is a distinct possibility that many minors could be cited. That's just the way it works. Now, how it would actually play out in court, that's another matter. But certainly a citation and being up on court view is an issue.
So as a former police officer, do you have any idea how anybody would prove who was drinking and who was not drinking? Or would they have to if the case was fought?
Sure.
They probably lose quite a bit.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, thank you for that question. So, yes, you would speak to the young people individually. You can smell the alcohol. You can see the effects of impairment. You may have a preliminary breath test instrument with you, a PBT. There are various ways you would be able to see who was actually drinking and who wasn't.
Thank you.
Representative Hughes?
Yes, thank you for bringing this bill forward. I was looking at on page 2 about the makeup of the board, and I recall, I believe it was last year, that we modeled the Marijuana Control Board after the original proposal for the makeup of this board, and now this has been changed. And I understand that this work, in order to get this to happen, it took place, and I get that. But I am curious on line 14-15, where we're actually prohibiting someone who has a public health background to apply for the general public seat, and I can understand perhaps you just want just an ordinary person, maybe a consumer or a non-consumer of alcohol. But I was wondering, could there's nothing to prohibit the rural member perhaps from having a public health background. I just believe that is important insight to have on the board, considering some of the severe problems we have in our state. And I'm just kind of surprised to see a prohibition of someone with public health background on lines 14 and 15 on page 2. Can you speak to that?
I can, Matt. And thank you, Representative. What the words say is affiliation. And the concern of the industry was that there might end up being a sort of, if you had the right administration, that you could perhaps stack 3 active anti-industry people on the board. And by affiliation, that means that obviously it's not going to be someone who's currently in that line of work or in a professional sense of being in a public safety sector or a public health sector. It doesn't mean that someone couldn't have been involved in the past, just like the rural public member might have that background. But it's an effort to try to balance the board. You've got two industry members. You have three potentially anti-industry members, and we felt that it was a fair compromise on balancing the board with the current makeup that you see in the bill.
Paula? Thank you for that explanation. It's good to know that the rural member maybe could have that affiliation, and that the general public person might have that former background. And, you know, the industry members I've spoken with, they seem to care about the public health in this regard. And so I was just kind of concerned when I heard that this change was occurring, particularly since we use that model for the Marijuana Control Board, and particularly understanding that we are one of the few states that even has industry representation on our alcohol board. So, and I was speaking with someone from, it might have been Jeff Jesse, actually, and I understand that the executive director does get up to speed quickly on the public health issues, and I think that's important, and I just for the record, I hope that will continue, because I think that's an important piece of information that the board always needs to keep in mind. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, may I?
Certainly.
I just wanted to remind the committee that this bill is about 10% or less of the work that still has to be done in this effort. My goal is a goal of consensus that brings the group, keeps the group together, working toward a common goal. So the way those things work is just compromise, and I'm okay with that. I think the end result will be far more beneficial than existing law.
Certainly.
I just want to thank you for indulging me, Mr. Chair, to make one more comment. I have lived in areas of the state where the public health concerns in this regard are very great, and it's just important that if we're setting policy in this area, that we aren't ushering in problems. We should make sure that there are opportunities for these communities to solve some of these issues, and so I was actually kind of excited last year when that public health, there was something worked out, and I have to admit I was disappointed when this was worked, but I'm glad to know that perhaps the rural person could have that background. I'm also glad to know that the executive director is kept informed of these issues. Thank you.
Representative Joseph, followed by Representative Ledoux.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to be clear, through the chair, the liquor industry has absolutely at least expressed no opposition to this bill, or have they supported this bill?
You should have. We certainly had an email on our side that they are in support of Senate Bill 165.
Actually, we have Dale Pox online later on.
And another follow-up on the minor consuming issue. As a prosecutor in Kotzebue, I have some memory of a young lady being in the office and saying she was, I think she may have been 18 or something, that she was revoked or suspended from driving until I think her late 30s. Can you, and I can look this up, but did she suffer a 90-day suspension, and then the next one was 180 days? It was something like that, and they just piled up. And I remember at that time thinking, this is a little out of control. Because my sense was she was sort of having a beer on the beach in Kotzebue or something like that.
Through the chair, for the record, Chuck Kopp, staff to Senator Manchiki. Representative Josephson, yes, you're referring to a problem where you can have offenses stacked and keep extending out that revocation period, which can go for a very long time. Now, if they were a minor at the time and to the 30s, there might have been a DUI in there too that might have kicked it out that far. Mm-hmm. But certainly, currently as it is, when you get into the repeat territory, you can be without the privilege to drive for a very long time.
And just a quick follow-up.
Certainly.
Did the under the current law, does it compound so that the third offense is worse than the second, et cetera?
Through the chair, yes, Representative Josephson, it does. The third offense, you are in misdemeanor territory, and the revocation gets longer.
Chuck, just out of curiosity, what's the record?
The record?
For stacking. How many years?
Through the chair, I wouldn't venture to guess, but I personally have never picked up a minor consuming that was more than their third time. More than 70% only offend once. So that's another reason why we're trying to delete these crippling nexuses, because most kids do learn on the first time.
Representative Ledoux.
Well, actually, I've got a question and then I've got a comment. The question is going to be, is the reason that they don't recidivate is because they age out of the offense?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, that certainly would often be the case.
And then I just want to thank Senator Michiki for the bill, because I think it's really in alignment with the omnibus crime bill that we're dealing with. So, thank you.
Thank you.
And with that, I think I will entertain a motion to adopt the CS.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move HCS CSSB 165 version 29-LS1384 /E is the working document.
And I'm going to object for two reasons. One, for purposes of discussion, and secondly, because we did not get the CS until early this afternoon, and when we got it out to the members, it was past the 24-hour cutoff. So it's my intention, because we're at the getting toward the end of session, to read the CS, not adopt it until tomorrow, but take public testimony and then have it be the first item on the calendar tomorrow morning. We're planning on recessing sometime in the next hour or so until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, so this will be just go in and out in a few minutes, but everything will be closed out except adopting the CS. And with that, I think Conrad Jackson will explain, which won't take too long. I was going to say Peter, but Senator Michiki.
That's we're quite familiar with each other. I just wanted to thank you, Mr. Chairman, for hearing the bill. I have to scoot off to finance, but I wanted to thank you and the committee members for getting this up, and happy to take any questions. Of course, Chuck's going to remain, but thank you very much.
And for the record, you like the CS, or you can live with the CS, or
I love the CS.
It's even better,
Mr. Chairman. It was a focus area of mine. I think what you've done is a great solution. So thank you for that.
Thanks again, Mr. Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Conrad Jackson, staff to Representative Olson. The CS before the committee, before version E, makes two identical changes, the first on page 5, line 3, the second on page 5, line 22, in both cases following $50. It inserts the language, for a person who has not more than one previous violation, or to $250 for a person who has two or more previous violations. The intent, the reason behind the CS, this was brought forward by a member of the committee. The concern is that, as I believe Mr. Kopp mentioned, most kids do learn on the first offense, some don't, and this just ups the penalty a touch for repeat habitual offenders. So it just limits how low the court can reduce the penalty.
Any questions for Conrad on the CS? Seeing none. Oh, and for Representative Culver, we're not adopting the CS until tomorrow, because it didn't. The committee did not have 24 hours to review it. So we're, yeah. That's one Conrad just walked you through. But what we're going to do is we're going to take all the testimony, close out public testimony. Come in tomorrow. We're going to recess in approximately 1 hour. Come back in at 9 o'clock, and that'll be the first item on the calendar. I believe we've already notified the Speaker's office that the bill will be coming over first thing in the morning. We'll probably have two or three set. I've got a feeling we're going to be on the floor most of tomorrow, so it'll give it a good chance to.
Can we have a brief at ease? I can brief you on something else that's happening, and then we can take our testimony?
Certainly. With that, I'm going to open up public testimony, and let's start with Dale Fox, Char, Anchorage, LIO, I believe. Dale, are you with us?
Yes, sir, I am.
Please say your name and affiliation, and tell us what you think of the bill and the CS.
Yes, sir. My name is Dale Fox, and I serve as the president and CEO of Alaska Char. Char supports SB 165 as a result of compromises made last week in the other body. I'm pleased to report that this bill provides for a number of excellent provisions, a balanced ABC board that will serve Alaska well, a new attempt at minor consuming that we hope will fight underage drinking, hopefully more effectively than previous laws, provides a fix to the golf course license, allowing those under 21 to play golf, a very healthy and wonderful sport, because the entire license, the entire golf course is a licensed premise. For those of you who golf, you know that there's a beer cart that goes around, so that makes the entire course of a licensed premise, and we needed to correct that, and this bill does that. It also provides for marijuana background checks. They do it a little differently than they are with the alcohol industry, but we're okay with that. So I'd like to encourage you to pass this bill so it might become law this year.
Thank you, Dale. Any questions for Dale? Thanks again, Dale.
Thank you.
Let's see. Jenny, KINAOIO. Are you with us?
Yes, actually I'm in Homer today.
Oh, okay, well, thank you for joining us, and please state your name and affiliation for the record, and thanks again.
Sure, my name is Ginny Espenshade. I'm the director of the Kenai Peninsula Youth Court. I just want to speak in support of and gratitude for this bill. I worked with Mr. Kopp in ensuring that the current diversion programs that are already handling these cases in many of our communities are included as an option for the underage drinking offenses, and they were very responsive and seeing that that was included. I also am very much support of the fact that these offenses will not appear on an online database. I've seen firsthand how that plus a probationary period for a young person can interfere with a lot of opportunities for their future, such as employment, higher education, and even military service. So I'm also here if anyone has any questions about the diversion programs, but I fully support this bill, and I'm glad the board issues got resolved so another year didn't go by where young people's futures were being unnecessarily jeopardized. Thank you.
Thanks again, Jenny. And for the record, Representative Seaton, Senator Machicki, Speaker Chenault, and I all share the second floor of the Kenai LIO with Jenny, so we know the valuable work that she does. Cynthia Franklin.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Cynthia Franklin. I'm the director of the Alcohol Marijuana Control Office. The staff and agency are in support of the bill for a number of reasons, and we appreciate the committee hearing the bill. Regarding the question from Representative Ledoux, the reason why wholesalers are prohibited from being on the board is due to what is called the three-tier system that was enacted immediately following prohibition, and it is an attempt to recognize the tremendous power that liquor wholesalers have and to curb their potential to wield sort of disproportionate industry influence. If there are any other questions regarding specifics of the bill, I'm happy to take it.
Any questions for Ms. Franklin? Thanks again for joining us, Cynthia. And I'd like to repeat that in the room we have Sarah Clark, Health and Social Services, actually online, Catherine Montefida, Department of Public Safety, questions only. In the room we have Jeff Jesse, questions only, Nancy Mead, court system, questions only, and Matt Davidson. Does anybody have any questions for any of the people that are available with answers? Seeing none, is there anybody in the room that hasn't signed up that would care to testify? Seeing none, is there anybody else online? With that, we will close out public testimony, and we will hold this bill over till tomorrow morning when it will be the first item on the calendar, and we will take a brief at ease. Next item on the calendar is Senate Bill 18, Healthcare Shared Service Ministry, Not Insurance. Pretty interesting title. Thanks for joining us, Reneva. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Reneva Moss, staff to Senator Coghill, and I have with me our intern, Kellen Fish, who is my lifeline. Senate Bill 18 is a one-section bill. It places in statute the current practice of the Division of Insurance to exempt health care sharing ministries from regulation as insurance because health care sharing ministries are charitable organizations. What this bill does, first of all, is it does exempt it from regulation as insurance, but it further defines health care sharing ministries consistent with the definition of those ministries in the Affordable Care Act, which exempts these ministries from requirements of the Affordable Care Act. The provisions in the bill mirror the provisions in the Affordable Care Act in that these ministries must be a 501c3, not-for-profit, exempt from taxation. They must be faith-based, and their participants must share a common set of ethical or religious beliefs. A person cannot lose membership after they develop a medical condition. The corporations must have been in existence since December 31st of 1999. And these organizations must have had medical expenses of its members that have been shared continuously and without interruption since December 31st, 1999. The final requirement is they must have an annual audit performed by an independent certified public accounting firm. There are currently 30 states that have this law in place, and they're referred to as the safe harbor laws. The reason they're referred to as safe harbor laws is because many of the states have passed these bills after there has been either a cease and desist or a threat that these nonprofit corporations would be regulated as insurance companies. The only other thing I would add is there are four major ministry corporations in the country. I've heard various estimates between 250,000 to 400,000 Americans that currently belong to these ministries. And in 2015, there were over $340 million in medical expenses paid by these ministries. Actually, not by the ministries, but the members of the ministries. And we're here to take questions.
Well, with only one section and zero fiscal note, I don't think we have to spend a lot of time on that. Who has the first question? Representative Hughes, followed by Representative Keto.
Thank you for bringing this forward. I know some people that get their medical coverage this way. Do you know how many Alaskans this would impact?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, between 3,400 and 3,500.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Keto.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And can you describe the services provided by one of these organizations? So is it you sign up and you get emergency support when you need emergency support, similar to people that might be doing fundraising for people with cancer, or is it an expectation of regular health care? Are they paying for your preventative maintenance, your annual checkups, any other like you would with your with a regular insurance company?
Through the chair, Representative Keto, the simple answer is it depends on the Articles of Incorporation, bylaws, and policies of each individual ministry. All of them may be different in some way. There are some ministries who have deductibles. First $300 of a medical expense is paid by the patient. The ministry does not pay the bills. The ministry administers communicating between the different members what the medical costs are, and it's up to the individual members to participate in donating their own personal money directly to the patient to pay for medical bills. So if you have a ministry that has, for instance, Samaritan Ministries has 20,000 members. So if a person has a medical bill a major medical bill that is, let's say, $5,000. That expense would be divided amongst those 20,000, and hopefully the perfect formula is that all 20,000 would equally contribute to the patient directly for that medical expense.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So one of the questions I have is, I guess we're saying that it's not insurance, but it sounds like it's operating quite a bit like insurance, where you just are, do you have, as an individual member, are you paying a regular amount, or do you receive this list of 50 people that have these things and you say, I'm going to give $5 to this person and $100 to this person?
Through the chair, Representative Keto, there is no guarantee that anyone will contribute any money. And that is part of the disclaimer when you join this organization, and that's why it's not an insurance. You are not guaranteeing a payment for a medical bill. You are asking the members of this ministry to contribute to that person to pay their medical bills.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is it 100%, or is there a retention or a deductible? Or
Again, Mr. Chair, it depends on the different ministry and what the rules of the game are with that ministry.
So it varies.
Yes.
Representative Jones?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, it's Reneva Moss, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Ms. Moss, this concept is expressly discussed in the Affordable Care Act, right? This is
through the chair, that's correct.
Part of federal law.
Through the chair, that's correct.
All right. May I?
Certainly.
If one applies, are they exempted from the requirement of obtaining insurance?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, yes.
Okay. And follow up? And again, that's according to the Affordable Care Act.
Through the chair, yes.
Thank you.
Representative Hughes.
I'm just curious. It is pretty, it's a fascinating approach, and just wondering, when the person is not guaranteed coverage, do you have any idea how it ends up playing out? Are things normally covered, just that people are good about
through the chair, up? Representative Hughes, in 1998, there was a court case challenging health care sharing ministries in Iowa. And the challenge was that it was truly an insurance. The court determined that it was not an insurance. And one of the basis for that was that the failure to pay rate was 0.5%. That was the success rate of the ministries, that people did, because of their connection and faith-based beliefs, did contribute, and bills were being paid.
Can you follow up?
Follow.
And my guess would be, along with that paying, they might have said a prayer for the people, because if they pray for them, they get better, the less they have to pay, right?
Yeah. And they'll go to heaven. Representative Keto.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the other questions I have is thinking about the operation of these ministries in Alaska. And would these ministries be registered as Alaskan corporations and Alaskan businesses? Or how would that work if you've got a group in Alaska? Do they share with a nationwide pool, or is it a state-only pool? And how is that set up? Is that state chartered, or is that just anybody can come in and just do this?
Through the chair, Representative Keto, these are nationwide health care share ministries. So Alaskans belong to a nationwide pool. And although I don't believe she's here, the Division of Insurance has been supportive of this bill, and has, in this current administration and in administrations since the 1990s, have treated ministries as not insurance. This is what we call the safe harbor law, to make sure that in the future coverage isn't interrupted by Division of Insurance deciding to regulate these ministries as insurance.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Is there anybody in the room that would care to testify on this bill? Seeing none, anybody online? Hearing none. With that, we will close out public testimony. What are the wishes of the committee?
Mr. Chair, I move SB 150, no, wrong one. I move SB 1818, version 29, LS0107-H from committee with individual recommendations and attach zero fiscal note.
Is there any opposition? This bill will move out of committee, and with that, we will take a brief at ease and
thank
set
you,
up for... we're back on the record. Next item on the calendar is Senate Bill 69, Board of Chiropractic Examiners and Practice. And presenting the bill will be Bill Stoltz, Senator Bill Stoltz. And please state your name and affiliation for
sure.
The record.
And
introduce
Stoltz.
Your companion.
Bill Stoltz. I represent Senate District F. It's a privilege to present this bill. Like a lot of other bills, I got interested in one aspect of it, and I saw the merits of the rest of it, and that was the issue of pre-sports participation physicals and the ability to the need to provide more opportunities, especially for areas of the state that don't have as many medical services, and the ability for rural kids to have better access to pre-participation physicals. That was my, I have to admit, it's not going to surprise you that a sports angle was my largest motivation. But it, this bill does a lot of other things, and it's the product of the work of the Board of Chiropractic Examiners, the state entity, as well as the Trade Professional Association, the Chiropractic Society. It puts Alaska, would put Alaska in the position on the issue of pre-participation physicals of 22 other states that would provide for that opportunity for patients to use this service for that. Alaska has it, but it has a strong deference to the school districts, and when you whether they will accept those or not, and including the Alaska School Activities Association, a group that I've communicated with, they defer to caution. As you know, often the legal community dictates the caution and that the entities will take in accepting anything where there's an uncertainty. The School Activities Association is not officially supported the bill. But they welcome the clarification so they can remove that that cloud in question of the acceptability. And certainly individually talking to many in the sports community in the high school or prep level or high school level is they welcome the opportunity. As I, what's one of my associations where I spend a lot of time. Other things, I could probably keep talking about sports. Can I defer to Mr. Brzezinski? He's actually more organized on all the other aspects, and I'd probably save the committee some time.
Certainly, Brandon. Can you read yourself onto the record, please?
Yeah.
Welcome back.
Thank you. For the record, Brandon Brzezinski, staff to Senator Bill Stoltz. Mr. Chairman, if you'd like, I could walk through a sectional analysis and talk about each section as to
certainly.
What... Yes, sir. So, Section 1 of the bill is adding a new language to allow the board, it's allowing new language for regarding the training and scope of practice of chiropractic interns and chiropractic preceptors. It's designating the designation of a nationally recognized certification program for chiropractic clinical assistance and also relating to the performance of patient examinations. This section is intended to... was intended to bring Alaska to national certification and credentialing standards for the chiropractic clinical assistance. it's also to ensure the appropriate level of training and certification of these chiropractic clinical assistants. And a chiropractic clinical assistant is similar to like a medical assistant or a physical therapy assistant. Section 2 of the bill is clarifying how chiropractors can accept referrals and authorizes the chiropractors to perform perform school physical examinations. This is what Senator Stoltz was just discussing with the committee, so I won't elaborate anymore. Section 3 is exempting chiropractic interns from AS 20100, the practice of chiropractic, because they're just interns and it wouldn't apply. Section 4 is just cleanup of language like regarding the issuance of temporary permits for licensed chiropractic examiners. Section 5 is regarding chiropractic clinical assistance, and it's intended to differentiate between the requirement of certification for personnel who provide clinical services through direct patient contact from those that perform administrative services of like a non-clinical nature. Section 6 of the bill is just more of a cleanup, a reclassification of terms. Right now, the name is it's changing the name of the peer review committee on the board to the utilization review committee. This is a name change only. The duties will remain the same. The intent is to change the public perception of how the committee is utilized. Currently, there's two services referred to as peer review. One involves a complaint against the practitioner's license. That also involves the Department of Law. The other is regarding a review of services provided by the practitioner. So this change would delineate between the two and allow for the proper routing of public requests received by the Board of Chiropractic Examiners. Section 7 is just conforming language to match language found in Section 2. And I believe there was some questions regarding Section 7 that I'm happy to address once I finish the sectional. Section 8 and Section 9, they increase the penalties for practicing without a license from $1,000 fine to a Class A misdemeanor. That's Section 8. Section 9 increases the penalty for attempting or obtaining a fraudulent chiropractic license from a $500 fine, increasing it to a Class A misdemeanor. Section 10, it amends the definition of chiropractic examination. It's to include those licensed as a chiropractic clinical assistant or intern as authorized by the board. Section 11 is amending definitions for chiropractic clinical assistant, chiropractic intern, and chiropractic preceptor. That concludes the sectional.
Did this bill pick up a finance referral?
Mr. Chairman, this has a fiscal note, a one-time of $2,500, and then after that, that's the routine setup, family fee for a board, for reestablishing a board, and then after that, it returns to a zero fiscal note.
I'm guessing with it being $2,500, you probably get it waived if.
Who knows what happens this time?
Oh no, but I think I've seen recently several of them that were slightly larger that were waived, so it might work. Any questions for Brandon? Representative Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I love chiropractors. I became a real believer. It was would have been 1988 in Seward. I was 8 to 9 months pregnant, and by 2 p.m. I couldn't walk and had 2 other children to tend to. And first time to a chiropractor, and it was miraculous. And most recently have taken advantage of Dr. DeSalvo in the Palmer Wasilla area too. I have a question on page 4, section 7. Where it says a person licensed under this chapter, and then down at the end of that paragraph, may only act within the scope of practice authorized by the board. So I'm just want to get on the record whether or not this allows the board to broaden its scope, or would this, you know, give the board the authority to broaden the scope in any way, or?
Sure. Well, I can tell you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hughes, this was we worked on this section with the medical, the traditional medical association community, and there was concern about they had concerns about how wide the scope was going, and this was a good faith effort between the two professions and our legislative office to accomplish the goals without without raising concerns about overly expanding the scope. And Mr. Brzezinski might have more elaboration.
For the record, Brandon Brzezinski, through the chair, Representative Hughes, I did contact legislative legal regarding your question, and they told me that statutes 0820100, 0820230, and, well, I should, let me back up. So 20.100 is the practice of chiropractic and explains like what chiropractors are authorized to do. 20.230 is another statute, again, relating to the practice of chiropractic, just even specifying even further what chiropractors are allowed to do. And then even further in the definitions on 20.900, you'll find the definition chiropractic examination, where it outlines like what is the scope of their practice. So they have to authorize within these, they have to perform procedures within these statutes. So they, you're not going to see chiropractors performing brain surgery.
Thank you for that. Very much I appreciate it. I have a grandson who is very sports minded. He's only 6 years old, but he had tetralogy of Fallot open heart surgery, and his dad's built like a football player, and you know, that's what that kid lives and breathes, and so I, you know, there's concern when a child like that might have a sports physical, and just wondering how that might work in that particular case. I'm sure mom and dad are probably going to have him with a heart specialist before he ventures off into football. But I am a real advocate of maximizing the scopes of providers to do the most that they can. That's going to make healthcare more affordable, more accessible. So I think that's a great thing. I had one more question, if I may, on just for my benefit, because I don't quite understand it. On page 2, lines 7 and 8, we're talking about, we're removing the word chiropractic, and then we're adding by chiropractic core methodology or by ancillary methodology. And I'm thinking that we're trading it off, and we're trying to get more specific there. And then I also, just what do we mean by chiropractic core methodology and ancillary methodology, or maybe examples of what the ancillary, is that like massage or?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, I'm going to defer to, if I may, invite Dr. Barrington from the Board of Chiropractic Examiners to come up and
We'll bring him up briefly.
Okay.
We also have Sherry Ryan from the Alaska Chiropractic Society for questions, and Janie Hovenden from Commerce Licensing is in the room. But we've got a couple more questions, and then we'll bring the good doctor up, Representative Keto.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On sections 8 and 9, I think for either of you, the penalty has been modified and reflects or identifies Alaska Statute 1255. Could I get an explanation of what that does as far as the penalty? So we're removing $1,000 or imprisonment for not more than a year. What does AS 1255 add?
Through the chair, Representative Keto, it is both these sections are increasing the penalties to a Class A misdemeanor, which is punishable by up to 1 year in jail and a fine of up to $10,000.
Okay, thank you. And then on Section 11, there is three definitions. One, chiropractic clinical assistance, meaning an individual enrolled in a nationally recognized certification program or somebody who's certified by the national organization. But when I read chiropractic intern, it seems to indicate that, see, a practice of chiropractic while under the personal supervision of a license under this chapter for obtaining a practical experience for licensure, but it doesn't indicate whether that intern is required to be enrolled in a program or can it just be any individual who may at some point decide they want to be a chiropractor and then they sign up to work for a chiropractor? So can you explain that a little further for me, please?
Through the chair, Representative Keto, that is correct. That these interns are just, they're there just to work and gain experience, and you know, as they build up towards either being a clinical assistant or chiropractor.
So follow up.
Certainly.
I think clarification, then, you're saying that they do not have to be enrolled in a program. They can be anybody off the street, and they will be getting experience, but maybe someday they will enroll?
Let's defer to the doctor.
Yeah, I'm going to defer to the doctor.
Yeah, I can wait for that one. Thank you.
Aye.
Representative Joseph.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For either gentleman, through the chair, my question really is about Sections 8 and 9 as well. Why has there been a rash of unlicensed practice, and why are you going to a stricter penalty when the legislature seems to be going the other way? And I'll note for Senator Stoltz that I share his concerns with the omnibus crime bill. So take that from that context.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. These are professional recommendations from the industry, from the state-sanctioned state-authorized board, and from the profession. So they're not evaluations I made. I don't really have the knowledge base to recommend those, and that's probably a Dr. Barrington message, who is also he has dual roles as a member of the Chiropractic Society and as a state board member, confirmed by the legislature.
Any further questions for the sponsor before we bring Dr. Barrington up? And with that, we'll open up public testimony. And Dr. Barrington, please join us.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dr. Edward Barrington. I am a chiropractic physician, and I thank you for allowing me to come and speak and behave on behalf of Senate Bill 69. I was born and raised in Juneau. It's always an exciting moment for me to come down here. I don't have to come as often as you do, I'm sure. I'm a graduate of the University of Alaska, also of the Palmer College of Chiropractic. I've practiced 33 years in Anchorage, and I currently am the chairman of the Legislative Committee for the Alaska Chiropractic Society, and serve on the Board of Examiners, Chiropractic Examiners. Both of these entities, the Chiropractic Society and the Board of Examiners, support Senate Bill 69. So, I'm here for questions.
Representative Hughes, followed by Representative Keto, followed by Representative Josephson.
Thank you for being here, Doctor. The question that I had, I don't know if you have the bill, but on page 2, lines 7 and 8, It was replacing the word, I think, replacing the word chiropractic treatment with treatment by chiropractic core methodology or by ancillary methodology, and just want to understand what we're doing there, if you could explain that.
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, by the way, thank you for your kind words earlier. I think, merely appeared to be redundant in the eyes of the committee putting this together. Chiropractic core methodology is chiropractic treatment. So,
and follow up?
Certainly.
And then what would be an example of the ancillary methodology?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, ancillary methodology is therapy modalities, ultrasound, muscle stimulation, exercise, diet, nutrition, oxygen, heat, cold, etc.
Okay, thank you. That's what I thought. Thank you.
Representative Keto.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think back to my question on Section 11, where it identifies the interns, and so if maybe you could just describe the process of becoming a chiropractor or becoming an intern, and then what an individual might be doing. Are they enrolled in an educational program? Are they just getting experience and then going into a program, or how does that work?
Mm. Through the chair, Representative Keto, an intern is a person who has satisfied all the graduation requirements of chiropractic college. So this is a person that has graduated or ready to graduate, and they are interested in a clinical setting for more training and experience, many times waiting for a board exam to come up, as boards are exams are sometimes only offered two or three times per year. And they will work under the preceptor, who is the supervising person, a doctor who watches them.
Follow up?
Certainly.
Thank you, and thank you, Dr. Barrington. Next is the chiropractic preceptor. Is that a certification or a certified individual, or is it just a chiropractor can decide to become a preceptor?
Through the chair, Representative Makito, it is a preceptor has to go through certain scrutiny in order to be able to host an intern. In other words, it's like being a foster parent. You know, you want to make sure that the foster parent's in good shape and able to help the intern appropriately.
And follow up?
Yep.
Thank you. And so the preceptor then would be that criteria, is that established by the board, or is that a national criteria?
Through the board, Senator Andrikino, that would be established by the board.
Okay.
May I add that currently several chiropractic colleges have wanted to send interns to Alaska, but cannot because the colleges require the state to have this in place for them to send them.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Joseph.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All the questions you want.
Yeah. thank you for Dr. Barrington. Just my question about Sections 8 and 9 on increasing the penalty for unlicensed practice. Can you tell us the origin of that?
To the Chair, Senator Josephson, these were recommended to us by the state investigators. We work with the investigative department, and they had suggested that we do it in this fashion because it makes it less messy. Just make it a Class A misdemeanor, and that pretty much conforms with other boards and entities.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions? Thanks again, Doctor.
Thank you so very much. And
again, we have Sherry Ryan online for questions. We have Jamie in the room that we all know. No licensing questions. Is there anybody else in the room that would care to testify? Is there anybody else online? Public testimony is closed. What are the wishes of the committee?
Move the bill.
Mr. Chair, I am happy to move SB 69 version 29-LS0704/S from committee with individual recommendations and attached note. Let's go on.
Any opposition? Seeing none, hearing none, the bill will move out of committee. Thanks again for bringing it to us, Bill.
May I have a comment,
please? Last item on the calendar, at least for this evening, is HGR 28. Frankenfish, I believe, isn't it?
It's Frankenfish.
Presenting the bill will be Representative Garantar and
Thatcher Brower, Staff Representative Garantar.
Thank you for joining us today, and you've got our undivided attention.
Hopefully the computer will work with me here.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Okay.
Did I get the wrong number?
HGR 28.
Oh, that's what I thought I said.
I missed it.
Oh.
I apologize.
Right.
You got it for the record.
Wrong on mine.
Okay.
I was right.
Okay. Good afternoon. I'm Representative Garantar, joined by my staff, Thatcher Brower, here. Thanks so much. What an interesting day from topic to topic, and we'll finish with Frankenfish.
Beginning.
HGR 28 is a resolution opposing the approval of genetically modified salmon. We're here today because last fall, for the first time ever, the Food and Drug Administration approved genetically modified salmon. This is significant because it's the first time a genetically modified animal has been approved for human consumption. So a lot of people are really concerned about sort of what this means in terms of our food system and what this might mean going forward. We've talked about this before in the legislature, so I think many of you are familiar, but just as a quick review, the genetically modified salmon that we're talking about, it's genetically modified using two different species, the Chinook salmon and then the ocean pout. One helps it to grow faster, and the other helps it to grow bigger. And so if you look at the picture on the right there, you can see the genetically modified salmon in comparison to the farm salmon. So it grows twice as big, twice as fast. And I think one of the reasons this is so important to me and why, even though we have significant budget situation that we need to address right now, is because our salmon industry, our seafood industry, is our largest private sector employer with about a $6 billion value for the state of Alaska. So I think this is something that's worth putting effort into and continuing to fight. I think our needs in Alaska are a lot different than the company Aqua Bounty, who has promoted this genetically modified salmon. The quote there from their website, just to give you an indication of, you know, sort of their motivation is very much about making profit and trying to, you know, use a technology that makes it more economically viable. In contrast, I think when we think of sustainable fisheries management, and the state of Alaska is really a leader both in our nation and internationally, and people look to us as a government that has done a good job with doing fish management, we think of images like this of, you know, wild Alaska salmon swimming upstream for spawning. We think of coastal communities that rely on the fishing industry to support their economy. We think of our Bristol Bay fishery that's known worldwide for having the largest sockeye fishery. So much in contrast to the images here, which are off of the Aqua Bounty website, that shows, you know, what some characterize as basically a laboratory experiment to produce this kind of food item. You can see in the image on the left, that shows sort of the land-based tank situation, and then the images on the right are the actual tanks themselves. The concerns about genetically modified salmon, and these are things that have been talked about quite a bit, the threat to the wild salmon, risks to human health, and risks to our state's economy. And the threats to the wild salmon really are because of the possibility of escapement. We know that Alaska fishermen have caught and have reported catching farm salmon. So we know there's a possibility, depending on where these were grown, that they could escape and wreak havoc on our wild salmon populations. And I know that the company says, well, these are grown in land-based pens, but this image here shows you actually where the eggs would be produced, and that is at a facility on Prince Edward Island. And you can see there the Bay of Fortune directly goes out into the Bay of Fundy and then meets up with the St. Lawrence Seaway and the Atlantic Ocean. So the way these genetically modified salmon would be produced is the eggs grown there, then flown to South America where they would be raised in the land-based pens, and then, you know, killed and come back to the United States to be sold. This stage in the development is very concerning for the escapement, and I have actually visited there. When I worked on the resolution in 2013, some of the activists there, the community members that don't want to be known as the home of Frankenfish, they were really alarmed. They rely on tourism for their economy, and they got really active on this issue because when you Google Prince Edward Island, the first thing that comes up is home of the Frankenfish. And that's not what they want to be known for. So when we were first started working on this before the approval, they were following the work of the Alaska legislature, very appreciative of us, you know, taking a stand, and ended up going to visit the location. So, you know, I've been there on site to see where this facility is located and why the concern is real. What we know from the research is that the genetically modified salmon can both outcompete and be more aggressive. The information was reported widely when a research report came out. This is from McGill University in Canada. And they bred the genetically modified salmon with wild brown trout, which is a related species, and were able to show that the hybridized species could both outcompete the genetically modified salmon and the wild counterpart. So, you know, this hybridized species really has people concerned about what the impacts could be if there was escapement into wild salmon fisheries. The risks to human health, I think at this point there's a lot of concern because the way this drug was approved by the FDA was as through the veterinary drug process. So people feel like it hasn't been sufficiently tested for risk to human health, but we do know there'd be exposure to those hormones that are used for growing the genetically modified salmon. And risk to our state's economy, if we use sort of history to learn from, when farm salmon came on the market, we saw that wild Alaska salmon took a big dip in the price, and this was pretty devastating for a lot of Alaska fishing communities. Since then, we have invested heavily in the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute to brand our wild Alaska salmon for the health benefits, because we have sustainable fisheries. And now ASME reports that it's one of the most recognized brands on restaurants, across the nation. So don't want to lose all that good work that we've done. We are not alone in opposing genetically modified salmon. And what really motivates me to do another measure like this is Senator Murkowski has been leading the charge since the approval last fall. There's a provision in the a statement in the resolution that speaks to the congressional delegation's activities as it relates to the FDA commissioner. They actually held up one of the commissioner's approval while they were waiting on getting commitments from them to require labeling. That's been a big concern. So I really applaud Senator Murkowski for her continued work. They spoke out both in the, with legislation and in the press. You can see here that retailers have spoke up, and many have said that they won't sell the genetically modified salmon. So the public pressure is really making a difference. Places like Costco, which is good for Alaska, have said they won't be selling genetically modified salmon. There's international opposition from those same folks. They have filed a lawsuit in Canada. They're continuing to work through their legal system and see if they can be successful there. And then since we presented in the House Fisheries Committee, there was a lawsuit filed in the United States with a broad coalition of food safety and fishing groups, and basically challenging whether the FDA had the authority under the law to regulate these genetically modified salmon, not as a food product, but as a veterinary drug. So that lawsuit is still ongoing, and we won't know, of course, the outcome of that for a little while. But suffice it to say that, you know, in the United States, in Canada, there are people continuing to fight approval and really think this is a wrong move. What we passed out to the committee was just some of the supporting documents, so you don't have to look through all of the different letters, but most of the major fishing groups, you know, in Alaska have come out and wrote letters. We've been working with them for the last few years. I think everybody's, you know, it's just an ongoing process, and I really believe it's the wrong thing, particularly because this is an entirely new development to go into genetically modified animals for human consumption. And if it's going to be approved, it needs to be done properly as a food product and really be tested for human health and environmental concerns. So I'm going to keep working on this. I appreciate your time today because we think it's just that important. And until, you know, I hope at one point we will, you know, be able to reverse that decision and we won't have genetically modified salmon. And with that, I would be happy to take any questions.
Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Representative Tarr, the November declaration or whatever by the FDA, do they have sort of absolute authority under their act to simply, I mean, how does one challenge that, or is it just a done deal?
It's through the chair, Representative Josephson. There are both legal remedies, which the folks who've come together in that coalition to file a lawsuit, they're taking advantage of that. And then there could be statutory remedies, such as what Senator Murkowski has done with doing the labeling legislation. Nobody has done legislation to ban the sale of them outright, but I think, you know, pending the outcome of that lawsuit, we might see something like that. We also put in a bill to ban the sale of genetically modified salmon, and just, you know, as something to remind us that is an option that's out there.
Through the chair, I assume that I mean, I'm stating the obvious, that if something said genetically modified, of course, they say it's genetically modified themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I assume that if something said that on a label, that they couldn't make it economically.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I think that remains to be seen. The United States is kind of alone in that we don't do much with labeling. Most European countries have moved on. A lot of European countries have banned a lot of the genetically modified products because of concerns about human health and impacts to the environment. I think we're a little bit behind in some of that work, but I expect that as we continue to work to strengthen our food system, that we'll see more measures like that come forward.
Thanks.
Brief at ease. Questions for the sponsor? Seeing none, what are the wishes of the is there any public testimony? Hearing none, seeing none, I will close out public testimony. And what are the wishes of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I move HJR 28, version 29, LS1213/H from committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Seeing or hearing no opposition, this bill will move out of committee, and we will recess until 9 a.m. tomorrow morning.